Despite the popularity of television shows like Dr. Phil and books like Chicken Soup for the Soul and The Secret, the phrase self-help continues to carry a stigma for many people. Jessica Lam Shapiro was raised by a child psychologist who wrote self-help books, and in her new memoir, Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture, she explores the current marketplace of self-help options, including vision boards, hot coals, and healing circles, in the hope of uncovering the truth about the promise of self-help. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jessica Lam Shapiro to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Did your father raise you based on the principles he wrote about?
He did. In fact, he used me as an example in a lot of his books. In his very first book, Games to Grow On, at one point he tells about a game that he invented that he used on me.
And did they work with you, these therapeutic practices?
I guess it depends what the intention was.
Did you feel like you were a guinea pig?
I did. But I was also very well behaved.
Did you grow up in a kind of self-help over-optimism, thinking that you could do anything?
In a sense, my dad was very much into positive thinking. He used to drop me off every day at school, and when I got out of the car, he would say, "Remember, today is the first day of the rest of your life." And I never really understood if he – I kind of thought he was joking because he would always be smiling.
Well, you weren't an alcoholic.
I was like seven. So, yeah, I mean, it was very much the first day of the rest of a long life at that point. But I assume it had some effect on me hearing that every day. I'm just not exactly sure what it is.
Your mother died mysteriously when you were very young. How did her passing affect your childhood?
In a very odd way. I mean, I'm sure it did affect me, but it was a very taboo subject in my family. And it just wasn't spoken about. So in a sense, I didn't think about it very much, so I didn't feel affected. But of course, it did affect me. And I kind of knew that there was something about me that was different from other children. Sometimes I had trouble relating to other children because of it.
And you end the book with at your mother's gravesite. So since this is really about self-help, which is largely your father's area, why did you do that?
Well, it was a surprise to me. I titled my prologue On Missing the Obvious because about halfway through the book, I realized that I was writing this book about self-help and that I wasn't really planning on mentioning my mother's death. And she had committed suicide, so it was actually relevant to self-help. And
your father had not been able to help her.
I think he had been unable to help himself with it, and so he had also been unable to help me. It's just a really, really difficult topic to address and to think about. So it was about halfway through when I started reading books on grief that I realized we were kind of going in this direction. And then some really nice things happened in our relationship where we were able to talk about it. And so I do end the book at her gravesite, which is something that we would not have been able to do if I hadn't written the book.
Now, when you started working on this book, were you looking to debunk some ideas about self-help?
I was extremely skeptical and cynical. I felt that it would be boring to write a book that was just debunking self-help because it would be extremely repetitive. So I was really interested in finding the good in it. And that was difficult sometimes, but I tried.
Some years ago, you went with your father to a weekend conference about writing self-help books. Wasn't Mark Victor Hansen, one of the authors of Chicken Soup for the Soul, the star of that event?
Yes, he was. Absolutely.
Well, he's become something of a celebrity. You even refer to him by his initials, MVH. Is his own story as inspirational as the stories he writes about?
Well, in a sense it is because it's the story of Chicken Soup for the Soul. Before he started that book, I think he was a businessman. I don't think he was poor and destitute, but he's obviously a millionaire with a huge career now. So in that sense, it is a success story.
Is it all that different from some of those self-help preachers who are out there? Because you describe the atmosphere as tent revival.
I felt like there was a very religious quality to it, especially within the audience. They were crying sometimes and they were shouting out, and it did have a very devotional quality.
Because there are some churches right now where the emphasis is on getting rich.
Absolutely, and there are churches that talk about self-help books. There's a self-help edition of the Bible. There's a big crossover space between religion and self-help.
What kind of exercises did Hansen have the people at this thing do?
Very strange exercises. One of them, he had us draw a smiley face on the index finger of our neighbor's hand and say, "I see that's you." And I did that with a stranger, and we all, 600 people, said, "I see that's you," all in unison. I'm still not really sure what that was about, but it was fascinating to me that one person could get 600 grown adults to do that.
I guess I see that's you, is I'm seeing somebody who's generally a positive person.
Yeah, but somehow the smiley face the on the index figure wasn't like a that powerful an image.
Well,
it was
silly. The Chicken Soup series now has more than 100 titles, like Chicken Soup for the Chiropractic Soul and Chicken Soup for the Fisherman's Soul. What do you think has made that series so popular?
It's just inspirational stories. I think people really love inspirational stories. I think we're hardwired to connect to them. And when you hear a story about someone else, we project ourselves into that story and we think, well, if that guy can do it, so can I.
Well, aren't women more likely to buy self-help books than men?
They are.
So do women buy self-help books and men buy how-to books?
Well, that's
are they related?
There's not a ton of research on it, which I wish there were because I find it very interesting. Women buy more books than men in general, so that could account for the difference. Some people feel that women are more introspective or more likely to ask for help. You know, there's that old joke about guys not asking for directions. It might be a similar thing.
A lot of the self-help message we often hear is be the star of your own life.
Yes.
Well, what does that mean, being self-serving? Isn't being the star of your own life what the message of Est, which used to be big but seems to have disappeared?
Be the star of your own life is interesting because on the one hand, it seems self-evident, and on the other hand, I actually have no idea what that means. I mean, it doesn't really mean anything. Of course you're the star of your own life. Are you the star of somebody else's life? Or, you know, I don't see really the alternative to that. There's a lot of interesting rhetoric that seems meaningful around self-help that when you really think about it and break it down, it's not really clear that it means anything.
I guess it's a way of saying you should put yourself first. It's almost an invitation to selfishness.
Yeah, well, it's general enough that it can actually mean whatever you want it to mean.
My guest is Jessica Lam Shapiro. Her book, Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture, is published by, who's publishing this?
Simon Schuster.
Now, how far back does self-help go? Is it true that there were self-help ideas that can be traced back to ancient Egypt or to Marcus Aurelius?
That's the argument that I make in the book. A lot of people cite Samuel Smiles' 1859 Self-Help as the first self-help book, and it is the first book that used those words. But I argue in the book that you can trace it back to ancient Greece, ancient Egypt, because basically when you compare those books that I was looking at to current books, they have exactly the same message. They're just written differently.
And then you cite a book from 1863, an inspirational story about losing weight called Letter on Corpulence that became really popular.
I love that book.
It advises a special diet, and it sounds like the Victorian version of something like The Biggest Loser.
Yes. In fact, it's very similar to the Atkins diet. I kind of see that as the first Atkins diet.
And then there was Dale Carnegie's best-selling How to Win Friends and Influence People series. Many bookstores even have a self-help section. Do they all sell so well? Is that why they have to have their own section?
Pretty much, yeah. They're extremely good sellers. In fact, on the subway here, I saw somebody reading How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's very serendipitous.
And that's a pretty old book.
It is, 1939.
Is the 20th century the century of self-help? 20th into the 21st?
I think every century is the century of self-help. It seems to be getting more popular as we go along, but it was also extremely popular in the 19th century.
But now we have the internet.
Now we have the internet.
Are we going to have self-help apps?
Self-help apps, web pages, probably robots. I mentioned a self-help robot in the book.
Now, you paid to attend a dating and marriage workshop called The Rules, based on the best-selling book?
Yes.
That book was promoted by Oprah. In fact, a number of the self-help successes have had their time on Oprah.
That's true.
Is she a major force in the self-help world?
It seems that she is. I mean, I know that when I went to that workshop, one of the things I overheard people saying before was that the women had been on Oprah, and that seemed to mean a lot to them.
What kind of rules did they give?
Basically, the idea behind the rules is playing hard to get. So, you know, don't show a man that you're interested. Never call him. They said set a timer when he calls and don't speak on the phone for more than 10 minutes. Just hang up. It was some very strange advice that I didn't feel that I could personally follow through with in good conscience.
So if you really enjoy being with someone, it doesn't matter. You hang up after 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But isn't it also about squelching your own personality to some degree and making him feel like he's the important one?
You're pretending to be a completely passive person. They claim that men have to be the aggressor, that they're biologically programmed to be aggressive. So that means women have to act passive.
Well, that sounds like the exact opposite message of books like The Feminine Mystique.
It is.
And is, you think that's part of the popularity? Is this kind of like a reaction to feminism?
Sure. I think it's a backlash. You know, I think one thing that's interesting about all self-help books is that they reflect the culture. So the feminine mystique reflects one part of the culture, and then something like The Rules reflects another part of the culture that might be uncomfortable with something like the feminine mystique.
One of the reasons that people trusted The Rules, as I said, was because they had been featured on Oprah, which is also where Dr. Phil got his television start. And Oprah introduced us to The Secret. The Secret gave us the vision or dream board. What's a vision board?
A vision board is a poster board, and you cut out pictures from magazines of things you want, and they can be concrete, like a car, or they can be abstract, like a relationship or a family. And you put them on the board, and then you just wait for them to magically happen.
And you have a friend, Cynthia, who got stressed, nervous, and excited about gluing things down.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun with that. She was a really good sport. But it was funny because, you know, she was just doing it as a favor to me, but she found that once she started doing it, it started to become very high stakes.
And that was supposed to, what is that supposed to do, attract positive energy?
Well, there's something that The Secret talks about called the law of attraction, and the idea is that there's a law that attracts things to you when you think about them.
Now, we don't have much time, but you also walked on hot coals, and I never understood why that was a matter of self-help.
I think that's about confidence and bravery. When you walk on hot coals, they tell you that if you have an intention, if you're thinking positively, that you won't burn yourself, but the real reason is actually physics.
Uh-huh. And some people do burn themselves.
And some people do burn themselves if they don't walk fast enough.
Do most of the TV self-help gurus like Dr. Phil and Dr. Oz have similar messages?
In a sense, they do. But in a sense, they all give different advice.
Jessica Lamb Shapiro will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 6:30 at the Corner Bookstore on Madison Avenue and 93rd Street. Her book, Promised Land. Published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.